Sudan has become a major issue at the UN Security Council because of a request for an arrest warrant by the International Criminal Court for Sudan's president, Omar Hassan al-Bashir. With me now for today's Underreported is Georgette Gagnon, who is the Africa Program Director of Human Rights Watch, and we've asked her to give us an update on what's happening in Sudan, including its proxy war with neighboring Chad. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
The big news from Sudan in the last few days has been this International Criminal Court's request for a warrant of arrest for President Omar al-Bashir. What's he being charged with?
He's being charged with crimes against humanity and genocide.
And what's prompted this request?
Well, it's obviously the facts on the ground and the situation on the ground prompted the request. Since 2003, the Sudanese government and its militias called the Janjaweed have been attacking civilians, committing war crimes, crimes against humanity, you know, very serious breaches of international law in Darfur, resulting in the displacement of 2.5 million people, the deaths of at least 300,000. So it's that in particular that prompted the warrant. The United Nations Security Council referred the situation of Darfur to the International Criminal Court in 2005. The court did an extensive investigation and then now has asked for a request, requested a warrant against the president.
Although it hasn't been issued yet. But as we saw with the Milosevic trial, it's kind of hard to make a direct connection between a head of state and crimes that are committed by people on a whole other level.
Well, it's not that difficult. Under international law, there's a doctrine called command responsibility. And that puts military or civilian leaders who are responsible for directing troops and others ultimately responsible for abuses committed by those under them. And, you know, the doctrine says that leaders knew or ought to have known what their troops were doing, if they were committing atrocities, and ultimately the leader is responsible.
Earlier today, former Algerian President Ahmed Ben Bella, he's also the chairman of an African Union panel charged with preventing conflict in Africa, he said that genocide charges against Bashir could lead to a lot of danger and could be an unconstitutional way of pushing aside a head of state. Do you agree?
The arrest warrant obviously, the request for arrest warrant obviously poses a risk on the ground. You can't minimize that. But it is the Sudanese government who is posing that risk. If they decide to, for example, attack civilians, attack the peacekeepers who are there, or block further humanitarian convoys, then those are the subject of further criminal charges. You don't respond to, you know, an indictment or arrest warrant by committing more crimes. What responsible power does that? And you also don't blame the prosecutor.
Well, why do you think he said it would be unconstitutional?
Well, that's unclear. Obviously, if Bashir is surrendered or surrenders and steps down, then there will need to be some change of power.
It's interesting that when you read news reports about this situation, usually Russia and China are cited as the two main obstacles. But here you have a former Algerian president and some African envoys to the UN are pushing to let Bashir avoid facing the charges. Is it because they're afraid that this thing could backfire and they could wind up facing charges themselves? Only Mugabe is in a situation that would be analogous.
Some African leaders, some within the AU, may think that the court or some other international justice mechanism might go after them at some point for crimes they've committed against civilian populations in their own countries. So that may be one thing. The other point is that many leaders, not only in Africa, aren't comfortable with the idea of an international court going after them and this principle of, you know, immunity by a state of head being undermined.
In the case of Bashir, it seems whenever the international court issues a warrant, he moves in another direction. In fact, he has promoted one of the people who was indicted earlier too. I think he runs the humanitarian. He's in the government running humanitarian affairs, which is kind of saying to hell with you to the rest of the world. Do you really think that he cares about whether anybody issues a warrant or not?
Well, it seems that he does, based on what's been said by others within the Sudanese government recently. That, you know, when the request for warrant was announced on Monday, and even before that, when the rumors were circulating, Sudan's ambassador to the UN made very threatening statements about what might happen if this was pursued. So it's clear that the Sudanese authorities do care that the international court and the international community is concerned about this.
Is there a peace process that is trying to negotiate an end to the conflict in Darfur?
Yes, there was a peace agreement signed a few years ago called the Darfur Peace Agreement between the Sudanese government and one rebel movement, which was always flawed because it was only one rebel movement, not a couple of the others that were also involved in the conflict. But that peace process since then has gone absolutely nowhere, and it appears to us certainly that both the Sudanese authorities and to some extent the various rebel movements are not keen on peace. They're preferring a military solution.
We do read a bit about Darfur in the media, but are we getting the whole story? Are we just simply getting the kind of the rehash of what's been going on?
Well, the very serious atrocities, the widespread massacres, war crimes, attacks on villages, the scorched earth, that is not occurring at this moment at the same level and intensity it was a few years ago. And that's simply because all the people have been displaced by and large. They're now confined in camps. They are unable to return home. They're living almost like concentration camp victims. So what you get now is more of a low-level conflict with some attacks on civilians, some bombing. And what's worrying is that over the past few months, as Human Rights Watch has documented in a couple of its recent reports, the conflict, the attacks on civilians, has escalated, and the government has resumed bombing of civilian villages.
With what goal?
To finally put an end to a couple of the rebel movements, keep them completely out of certain areas.
To move other people in?
That may be one goal. There's certainly some evidence, although we have not confirmed it at this point, that the Sudanese are moving in their supporters into certain parts of Darfur that have been cleansed and cleared of Darfurians from other ethnic groups.
My guest is Georgette Gagnon, who is Africa Program Director for Human Rights Watch. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Another conflict in the area that's not getting much attention is the proxy war between Chad and Sudan. Can you give us a sense of the geography there for listeners who aren't really familiar with it?
Chad and Sudan are neighboring countries. They are side by side. They share...
So they have a long border?
They have a very long border, which is porous. And there's a lot of movement of people, animals, military forces, militias across the borders. The different groups of people also share the same ethnicity across the border.
So that's why so many Darfuri refugees are in Chad. Has the conflict spread to Chad?
Yes, it has. We again documented this extensively over the last couple of years and put out a report called Darfur Bleeds, which was really the first report that showed how the conflict from Darfur had spilled over into Chad. There was huge movement of Darfuris into Chad. And then inside Chad, what happened is there were attacks on civilians by Sudanese government-backed militias.
The Janjaweed
had moved into Chad, which, you know, was a very worrying situation.
Well, couldn't Chad have secured its borders and prevented those people? You can let the refugees in, but keep the killers out?
Well, there was a lot of discussion and controversy over how that happened, but As I said, the border is very large. It would be very difficult for the Chadian military to secure that border. And, you know, there may have been elements within Chad that were quite happy to see these militias come over.
Now, have these countries always had tensions, or is this something that has developed because of the crisis in Darfur?
No, there's been longstanding tensions over a number of issues, you know, land, access to power, different sort of issues. But it certainly heated up with the tensions in Darfur.
How far back does the proxy war actually go? We're calling it a proxy war. Why that?
Well, it's called a proxy war because each government has got its own proxy, be it a rebel force or a militia, that's fighting the other.
So, in other words, the army, the Chadian army and the Sudanese army are not fighting. What they got going there is rebel groups who are fighting each other in the name of. And is there deniability here?
There is certain efforts to deny, but there's quite strong evidence that the so-called proxy forces are supported by each government.
And why are they fighting for these governments? Is money involved?
Well, money may be involved, but more importantly, these groups are provided with weapons. They're provided with also, unfortunately, the opportunity to loot and steal cattle and camels and other pieces of wealth from the villages and the civilians they attack. That's how the Sudanese government attracted and keeps the Janjaweed aligned with them.
What about the people fighting for Chad? Are they Chadians or are they Sudanese?
They're mainly Chadians from various groups, which there has been some evidence out there that the Sudanese government does support them.
Wasn't there a peace deal signed by Chad and Sudan earlier this year?
There's been many peace deals signed by Sudan and Chad over the years, which are signed and then broken and then re-signed and rebroken.
What did they agree to?
Well, they would have agreed to not attack each other's forces, not to cross over into each other's territory, those sorts of things. But they never keep these. Something always comes up and then they break them.
Because, again, they can say, well, we didn't do it. Anyway, it was those rebels who did it, and we had nothing to do with that.
That is why you often get a proxy force, as you mentioned earlier. It's the deniability factor.
So what are the governments in Khartoum and in N'Djamena, that's Chad's
in N'Djamena. Mm-hmm.
In N'Djamena, Chad's capital. What are their major interests in keeping this proxy war going? Do they have eyes in each other's territory?
Well, that's not exactly clear. There may be some of that, but there also may be some personal and what we would call ethnic differences between the governments, which has come to the fore in this conflict.
Well, Chad's president, Idriss Deby, has been under attack from his own country as well. He has his own rebel forces who would like to see him overthrown. That's not the case with Bashir in Sudan. He seems to be relatively stable in his position as the president. But is that insurrection, the Chadian insurrection, also part of this whole thing?
Yeah, it is part of the effort by Chadian rebels to overthrow Deby, and also, as we discussed earlier, there are different Chadian rebel groups. Some of those rebel groups are supported by the Sudanese government.
And Deby has been supported by the French. They sent some forces in there?
Yes, there is quite a large French contingent in Chad. There's also now a European Union force there, which is mandated to protect civilians in refugee camps
in
Chad.
And that at the request of the French, because Chad is a former French colony?
No, the European Union as a whole agreed to put in place the EU force, and the Chadian government actually requested the force.
So because Sudan hasn't requested a similar force, there's no EU force in Sudan?
No, but as you know, there's two UN forces in Sudan. There's the UN force that is monitoring the North-South Peace Agreement, And then there's the UNAMID force, which is the hybrid African Union UN force that is in Darfur trying to protect civilians.
But relatively ineffective because they made a deal with Bashir that gave him all the power, didn't they?
Yes, some people...
How did that work out?
some would argue that the UNAMID force was flawed from inception because it gave Bashir sort of a pass on a number of the elements of deployment. For example, approving what country troops can come from. And Bashir does not want non-African troops as part of UNAMID.
He also won't allow in helicopters and armored vehicles. He has prevented them from building barracks. The force is, I think, one-third what was originally agreed to. So it's kind of a joke, isn't it?
Well, we wouldn't say it's a joke. We would say that if the Security Council put some real muscle behind its statements, the force would get deployed.
But is that possible with, as we said earlier, Russia, China, and any number of African and North African countries doing everything possible to prevent any real action there?
At some point, our view is that these countries are going to get fed up with the situation in Darfur. And, you know, as far as the Chinese are concerned, they might almost be there. Because the situation, as it becomes more and more unstable, it, of course, affects their business interests and their ability to conduct business properly and develop oil in the way that they want.
But we're seeing a number of areas that are really unstable in Africa, and they seem to be situations that can't be fixed. Somalia, one of them. Ethiopia's ongoing campaign in the Ogaden. We have Zimbabwe with Robert Mugabe. Again, in all cases, part of the problem is that certain people don't want to have these conflicts resolved.
Well, in most cases, it's actually one of the members, one of the parties to the conflict that is most at fault in not seeing it resolved. And, you know, for example, in Ethiopia, the Ethiopian government and its troops are committing war crimes both in Somalia and in the Ogaden region. The Ethiopian government is supported heavily by the U.S. and the U.K., who view it as its strategic partner in the, you know, in their war on terror.
So in this case, the United States is supporting Ethiopia, which is committing atrocities. In the case of Sudan, it's China largely because of economic interests in Sudan?
Yes, some would argue that in the case of China, although they're not directly engaged, they are indirectly complicit in the war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Why are the Russians supporting Bashir?
Well, it's not a question of supporting or not supporting. They also provide arms to the Sudanese government and to many other governments, you know, across the world. Also, they have a policy like China of, non-interference in the internal affairs of other countries, and also a policy of not supporting, for example, targeted sanctions against individuals or economic sanctions.
My guest on Underreported today is Georgette Gagnon, Africa Program Director of Human Rights Watch. We will continue our conversation after this. And we're back with Georgette Gagnon, who is Africa Program Director of Human Rights Watch. We're talking about the current situation in Sudan, Darfur, but beyond Darfur, and the proxy war that has developed between Sudan and its neighbor Chad. And Sudan has accused Chad's President Deby, of helping Darfur rebels attack Khartoum. What's that all about? And why haven't we heard more about that in the newspapers?
That is really an underreported story. On May 10th of this year, the Darfur rebels called the Justice and Equality Movement did launch an attack on Khartoum, which is Sudan's main city.
Now, would they have necessarily been doing it at the behest of Chad, or because of what's going on in Darfur, just do it because they thought that that was a way to get directly at Bashir?
Yes, it's unlikely they would have done it at the behest of Chad. the Darfur rebels, the JEM, have their own views about the Sudanese government and, of course, have been fighting it for several years now in Darfur. And this attack was really viewed as a way for them to call attention to their aims and their situation and the situation of Darfuris.
How many people were killed?
That is very unclear because there has been no investigation done by any independent group. Also, the Sudanese government has not put out any figures on how many were killed. Human Rights Watch did an investigation right after the fighting and were able to document at least 60 people were killed. These would be civilians. There may have been, of course, fighters killed as well, but our concern is with civilian deaths.
And how did the government in Khartoum react to the attack?
They brought in their own forces, and then, which is very worrying, is they got their security forces to round up, take off the street, off buses, other places, all those people, mainly Darfurians, whom they believed to be supportive of the rebels. They arbitrarily arrested them, and many are still in detention.
Since Darfuris are darker skinned than the Arabs of the north, would there be a racial component here?
There may be. I would not. What you just said, I would not say that's you know the thing across the board.
Because this has been an issue in the past, religion, and also skin color.
Well, it's not skin color. It's ethnic affiliation is one key part of the tensions between Darfur and the Sudanese government. But religion is not a factor because all the people there are Muslim.
In the case of Darfur,
yes.
In the other civil war, it was Christians against Muslims, but here it's Muslims against Muslims.
Yes, if you want to phrase it that way.
How many of the people who were rounded up are still in prison?
Well, the exact numbers are very unclear. We documented that at least 200 people, and these are men, women, and children, were rounded up and put into prisons in Khartoum. Some numbers go up as high as 3,000.
Wow.
The Sudanese government itself released about 400 people a few weeks ago. So, you know, it is just unclear, but we know for sure there are still probably several hundred people still in prison. We call them disappeared, which is a very serious crime because there is no information on their whereabouts or even their names that they're in these prisons.
Is Khartoum capable of controlling press reports of situations like this?
Absolutely. Khartoum maintains very strict control over the media in Sudan, and it clamps down on all forms of independent media. There are some media outlets operating in Khartoum. For example, the BBC does have some reporters there and some others. But the state-controlled media is very, very tightly controlled by the government.
I mentioned that the Sudanese government pretty much flaunts its power in relation to what the world has decided. A little over a year ago, the ICC issued arrest warrants for two men, Ahmed Haroun and Ali Kashaib, for their alleged roles in crimes in Darfur. And one of them has been promoted to Minister of State for Humanitarian Affairs in Sudan, and the other one has been just allowed to run free.
Yes, the Sudanese government has thumbed its nose at the court, the International Criminal Court, so far, and refused to cooperate with it or surrender these two suspects.
So if the Sudanese government refuses to comply with an international court, what can be done?
The matter would go back to the Security Council, and it would be requested to use various means to try and get the government to comply, such as sanctions against leaders, other forms of pressure.
But it seems to me what's happening a lot more is that other groups are trying to apply pressure by picketing and boycotting transnational corporations that are involved in trade with Sudan, the pressure to boycott the Beijing Olympics, or at least do something symbolic in relation to that, to protest what China has been doing in Sudan. Are they having any impact?
The China Olympics movement, or the, you know, it was called the Genocide Olympics, did have some impact, because we did see some movement by China on Darfur on a couple of points. And, you know, they became more vocal publicly in their concern about the situation. They also appointed an envoy to deal specifically with Sudan and did a couple other things. But, you know, in our view, it's not been nearly enough, of course.
Well, we saw in South Africa that if the world really wants to, it can apply an awful lot of economic pressure and force a country to change. Could that happen in Sudan as well, or would trade with China and perhaps Russia be enough to keep the government afloat?
That is what has been the case so far. There are very few what one would call Western corporations operating in Sudan. There's Chinese, Malaysians, Indians, others.
But I understand that there are any number of people who or public institutions that continue to invest in groups in companies that work in Sudan. In fact, I think New York City right now is being pressured to divest itself of some of the stocks it owns, but it's refusing to do it.
Yes, there has been for many years, even when the North-South War was going on, a divestment campaign, particularly in the U.S. and in Canada, to try and get people to divest themselves from pension funds that have any interest in companies doing business in Sudan. And that also has been somewhat successful, but, you know, unfortunately, it hasn't changed the situation for people on the ground to a huge degree.
Jan Eliasson, a Swedish diplomat who was the UN's mediator in Darfur until June, told the New York Times recently that he'd been very frustrated in trying to advance peace talks and that things won't improve there until all countries with leverage in Sudan put pressure on the government, militia groups, and rebels. That sounds impossible.
Well, it wouldn't be impossible if all countries did come together. And Human Rights Watch has always said that the problem is that there has not been a unified, consistent, concerted, strong effort by all members of the Security Council, for example, to be very tough with Sudan, and that has been the problem. There's no question.
My guest is Georgette Gagnon, who's Africa Program Director of Human Rights Watch. The civil war in southern Sudan officially ended in 2005 when the Comprehensive Peace Agreement was signed. And how has that held up?
It's been holding up fairly well. Recently, there has been some fighting between the southern government forces and Sudanese government forces in an area called Abyei, which is a border area. And they've been fighting over where the border actually is, because it divides the north from the south, and it's also in a very oil-rich region. And this has been a contentious issue for quite a while. However, they did recently sign something called the Abyei Roadmap to deal with this.
Is that where so many of the conflict, what so many of the conflicts arise from? The fact that there is all sorts of natural resources in this country.
Well, the main issue in Sudan has been the oil and who has control or who has access to that oil and whose territory, the north or the south, is the oil on.
But this is not Saudi Arabia. There can't be that much oil in Sudan.
There's some good reserves, and there's also some investigation and development going on into reserves in other parts of Sudan.
I read earlier this week about a school in Wau in southern Sudan that's been closed for 20 years, and it just reopened. So there are positive signs there as well.
Yes, there are some positive signs, certainly. There is a peace dividend that has arisen, but there's much, much more that needs to be done.
And why do you think what has been learned from that conflict can't be applied to Darfur?
Well, one must remember that the North-South conflict went on for 21 years before there was a peace deal. Darfur's only been going on since 2003. Unfortunately, I mean, that's a terrible indictment of all of us that these conflicts are allowed to fester. It is the thing that finally did it in the South was, as we discussed earlier, a concerted effort by the key countries, in particular the U.S., to get a deal, to get all the rebel movements together, unified with one position. In the South, they also had a very strong leader in John Garang who could do that. And this is what led to the deal and also recognition by Khartoum finally that we're not going to win militarily.
There's no equivalent in Darfur to John Garang.
Not at this point. There are disparate rebel movements there. One big problem has been that they are not united. They need to get together. If they don't, this just permits Sudan to divide and conquer.
When's the last time you visited Sudan?
I haven't been in Sudan for a few years. Our team gets in and out frequently, and I'd like to go back, but some of us at Human Rights Watch have a little problem with getting a visa.
Well, last time you went was as a representative of the Canadian government.
No, I actually did go more recently than that. I went in with the consent of the Sudanese government in a delegation with others from Human Rights Watch. And we were able to get to Darfur. Since we issued our report on that visit, we have not been allowed back in.
This morning on NPR's Morning Edition, there was a piece about how Khartoum is a lot more cosmopolitan than people might think. Was that your experience?
Yes. I was passing through just a year ago. I didn't spend a lot of time in Khartoum. But with oil money, and with the UN mission, there's been quite an increase in cars, building, restaurants, different communities coming into Khartoum.
What other countries border on Sudan?
Well, there's...
I'm just thinking about how wars of this sort tend to destabilize a whole region. We've seen that in Congo. We've seen that in Uganda. And I suspect, in this case, not just Chad, we've seen it in Ethiopia and Eritrea. So do you think the same sort of thing is happening here?
Well, Sudan, some would say it has been a factor in destabilizing, you know, certain parts of East Africa. The main other country that's been affected is the Central African Republic, which also borders both Chad and some parts of Sudan. So there has been some impact there as well.
How safe is the area for NGOs at this time?
Which area?
Well, Darfur and the border with Chad.
In Darfur itself, there has been a great increase over the past few months in attacks on humanitarians and humanitarian convoys. And this has been carried out by all kinds of different actors. So it's not that safe for humanitarians. And, of course, that impacts the people of Darfur and their ability to get food and health care.
On a series we call Backstory, we did a segment on Omar Hassan al-Bashir and how he came to power. And we have posted a link to that on our show page at WNYC.org. This is another one of those things that shocks me, that if you ask anybody, how did Bashir come to power? Who is he? Practically nobody knows.
Well, he came into power through a coup. He was not ever democratically elected.
An alliance with a religious figure. And
yes.
Then he got rid of his coup partner.
He did. And some suggest that his coup partner is now a key player within one of the rebel movements in Darfur.
So there are all sorts of other kinds of political struggles going on.
Yes,
here.
There are.
We'd love to have you back sometime because we do want to talk about what's going on in Ethiopia. And I'd love to know what you think is happening in Zimbabwe and why that situation has turned out to be so intractable. So I hope that within the near future, we can talk to you again. Is that all right?
Yes, and thanks very much.
Well, we have been talking about the situation in Sudan, not just in Darfur, but also as it relates to what has turned out to be a serious proxy war with Sudan's neighbor, Chad, with Georgette Gagnon, who's African Program Director of Human Rights Watch. Does Human Rights Watch have many people in the area? I mean, how often do you monitor it?
Yes, we are constantly on the ground in Darfur, Sudan, Chad, Central African Republic, also in Zimbabwe. We've put out lots of reports and material on these countries, which is available on our website.
Thank you so much for being with us today.